I couldn't not talk about Magna Carta in this, its 800th anniversary year, even though by this time, in 1215, Magna Carta had been repudiated by the king and condemned by the Pope, and England was on its way to civil war. The big events of the year were on the 15th of June this year. But Magna Carta is, as the name suggests, this great charter which King John was forced by his rebellious barons to seal, to issue on the 15th of June, 1215. It wasn't just for the barons. Magna Carta proclaimed the liberties of all free men. And it's that above all that makes it famous today. And the liberties which the king granted for himself to his men were to be observed by others in respect of their own dependents. It's been lovely for medieval historians this year, 13th century historians. The interest and enthusiasm that the celebrations have inspired has been amazing. Of course, you would expect 13th century experts, David Carpenter, Nicholas Vincent, to be called upon to talk and to write about Magna Carta. But the events have gone way beyond academic circles. The celebration at Runnymede on the 15th of June was attended by Her Majesty the Queen and other members of the royal family. Also by the Archbishop of Canterbury, very appropriately, as we shall see, the Prime Minister, the United States Attorney General, and many others. And there have been commemorations in all sorts of places in England, in Britain and abroad. Some of them with a recently discovered association with King John and Magna Carta, perhaps rather unexpected. There are splendid exhibitions, including online exhibitions at the British Library, at the Bodleian Library, at the National Archives in Kew. And in a way, the events that have commemorated Magna Carta have become part of Magna Carta's own history, because they've created a record of what in the Charter is seen to be important today, 800 years later. What strikes me, perhaps especially at the moment, is how fortunate that we are that so many of the sites associated with King John and with Magna Carta are accessible, are open, and are properly preserved. They're funded, whether publicly, institutionally, or by the generous donations of individuals and visitors. Runnymede, for example, where the charter was sealed between Windsor and Staines on the Thames. The cathedral, Worcester Cathedral, in which John was buried and where his tomb is still intact. The libraries and the archive repositories where the original copies of Magna Carta are housed. The British Library has a 1215 version. The National Archives in Kew, where you can even, anyone can go and order a copy of Magna Carta on the charter roll and hold it in their hand. If, however, you do that, you must be prepared to hold it very carefully indeed and not touch it and use the appropriate weights, just for health and safety of the document. At Oxford, of course, we're very fortunate to have our own copy in the Bodleian Library of the 1217 version of Magna Carta. So I'm sure, you know, this time next year and next, the year after that, and in 1225, we'll be doing this again. I do hope so. And of course, here in Rewley House, we're just a few yards away from where King John himself was born in 1167 at the King's Houses on what's now Beaumont Street. So do go and have a look at the plaque there. Well, the houses don't exist anymore. Just as those who've been involved in the commemorations of Magna Carta amount to a sort of roll call, in a way, of the good and great in the political establishment now, so the preamble to Magna Carta, not the first clause, but the preamble, was a sort of enumeration of those who mattered in the early 13th century. You'll have heard, or read that Magna Carta is the first item on the statute book. But in fact, oh, must have said something. It was made before statutes were... I'm shedding light on the nature of royal charters in the 13th century here. It was a charter. It was the way in which a king made a grant to his people. A royal charter is the most solemn and important document you can have in the kingdom. And it begins with a proclamation of the king and his titles, and it's addressed to everyone. And the categories of what constituted everyone show you the articulation of 13th century society. We don't exactly know what the process of distribution was. We think that Magna Carta was copied out, and each copy, when you look at how long it is, would have taken ages to do. And then it was sent to the bishops in their diocese for safekeeping and onward distribution. The charter opens. John, by the grace of God, King of England, Lord of Ireland, Duke of Normandy and Aquitaine, and Count of Anjou, greeting to the archbishops, bishops, abbots, earls, barons, justices, foresters, sheriffs, reeves, ministers, and all his bailiffs and faithful men. So the enumeration of those people isn't just according to a template, it's a reminder to those people that they're going to need to take notice of the charter's terms. They're going to be affected by its provisions and responsible for keeping them. The charter then goes on to explain that it's been granted by divine inspiration for the salvation of our soul and for the souls of all our ancestors and heirs, for the honour of God and the exaltation of Holy Church and the reform of the kingdom. The mention of the reform of the kingdom is a hint that something has been amiss. And so too is the fact that the charter has been given on the counsel of the Archbishop of Canterbury and other named bishops, the papal legate, the master of the Knights of the Temple, and the top earls and barons in the kingdom, beginning with the famous William Marshall, Earl of Pembroke. And senior royal officials are named as the councillors. The fact that the preamble needs to name those who have been responsible for influencing the king to do it is a further hint that something has been going very wrong. Magna Carta belongs to an age where, when the use of the written word was spreading rapidly as an instrument of law and government. John's father, Henry II, his brother, Richard, and John himself had all been issuing charters, particularly to the new towns which were springing up, giving them charters of liberties. Monasteries were increasingly asking, indeed demanding, when people gave them gifts, that those gifts be confirmed by actual written deeds. It was the idea that the written word, having written testimony to what you had, gave your possession greater force. Sometimes, and this is important for Magna Carta, the deeds of monasteries confirmed what they already had, and the same is true of towns. When you look at the clauses of Magna Carta, you think, well, some of these things are already being done or should have been. Some of them are prospective for the future. But the point was with Magna Carta, it wasn't just, oh, well, writing's fashionable, so let's just, you know, have a little collection of the laws and customs of the realm. It was because John had failed to observe the laws and customs that they needed to be codified in this way. It's necessary to embody the whole community's liberties and the limitations on royal power and officialdom and the responsibilities of the king towards all of his subjects. So Magna Carta professed to be the king's document. It bore the Great Seal, which only he could use. And this talk is being broadcast live. So I do want to say that I have tried to be very patient when people talk about Magna Carta being signed. It was sealed, but of course that was a sign of royal approval, of royal authentication. But with Magna Carta, those things even were insufficient. The terms of Magna Carta were to be upheld by what historians talk about as the security clause, which was that a committee of 25 barons were going to uphold its terms. And if the king or his ministers were to infringe the terms of Magna Carta, then Magna Carta gave them the right to make war on the king. And anyone else was allowed to join in. The king himself took an oath to observe the terms of Magna Carta. In the idea of the king giving his subjects a charter, some credit must go to one Stephen Langton, the Archbishop of Canterbury. Our knowledge that he played some part comes in the first place from the chronicle of Roger of Wendover. Roger of Wendover writing in the early 13th century at the Royal Abbey of St. Albans. And according to Roger, there was a meeting between Langton and some of the rebellious barons. And he drew their attention to the existence of the coronation charter of King Henry I. And Roger Wendover's account suggests that this was a sort of eureka moment where the barons say, we're just trying to think what to do to remedy the king's evil ways, and you've come up with the perfect solution, a charter. And Langton, according to Wendover, promised to support them in gaining this charter of liberties. In fact, historians now doubt whether such a precise meeting in those terms really took place. The coronation charter of Henry I being, in fact, already well known to people. But like many stories in medieval chronicles, while it may not literally be true, it does reveal and is intended to reveal an underlying truth that people did appeal to established custom when trying to do something new, that the authority of things past was very great, and that there was a bookish, learned Archbishop of Canterbury who believed that the king should rule under the law. The clauses of Magna Carta that are most famous and the most celebrated, I think, are absolutely precious as an articulation, a lasting articulation of a proper relationship between the individual and the state. No free man is to be pursued or persecuted unless by the judgment of his peers or by the law of the land. To no one will justice be denied or sold or delayed. But I've chosen today to talk about the first clause of Magna Carta. The parts of Magna Carta, the way in which they're ordered doesn't necessarily follow a logical progression. And those two specially famous bits are almost lost in the middle. But the one that's given pride of place, the very first clause, which is why I chose it, is put at the beginning deliberately, explicitly, and for a reason. It says, in primis, in the first place, we have done the following. And what the first clause does is grant the freedom of the English Church. It follows the layout of the Coronation Charter of Henry I, which did the same thing. And Henry I's Coronation Charter promised not to interfere with the property of the Church. also giving Magna Carta its first clause, giving the liberties of the English Church, reflects the fact that the Church, the clergy, are the first estate in a society whose traditional divisions were between those who pray, those who fight, and those who work. The Church is the first. It's the estate which prays. So in this first clause, the King has granted to God and confirmed by his charter for himself and his heirs forever that the English Church is to be free and have its rights holy and its liberties uninfringed. And this is to be observed, as it's clear from the fact that the liberty of elections, which are considered to be the greatest importance and necessity for the English Church, the King acknowledges that he has already granted and confirmed by a previous charter before the civil war between himself and the barons, and that liberty of elections was confirmed by Pope Innocent III. And he goes on to say that we wish this to be observed, and we will observe it, and our heirs will observe it. This granting of liberties sounds generous, it sounds unstinting, it's a gift to God, making the clause in a way a sort of spiritual act, as an act of piety on the part of the King. But to understand it in context, we need to look a little more deeply. And there are two characters with relationships with John who lie behind it. So the clause makes clear, the first clause of Magna Carta makes clear that the main infringement of ecclesiastical liberty had been to do with elections. When a medieval archbishop or bishop or head of religious house died, his successor was supposed to be chosen by the monks of the cathedral priory or the cathedral chapter, or if it's in the case of a religious house, by the monks of the abbey. In practice, the process of electing a new head of house was far too important to leave to holy men. The Archbishop of Canterbury in particular was a key political player. When he was the King's friend, he was a crucial ally. He might even be one of the King's ministers. When he was not the King's friend, it was a wasted opportunity, and he could be a dangerous and powerful enemy. Like all bishops and abbots, the Archbishop of Canterbury is a tenant-in-chief of the crown. He's a great landlord. And when you look at the wealth of the medieval church, and you can still see it in today's place names, in cathedrals, in abbatial buildings when they survive, the church was a very important landlord in the Middle Ages. This business of influencing elections or controlling elections and the rights of kings in elections had indeed been a bone of contention for generations. We're not just talking about John. John's father, Henry II, had tried to insist that a bishop should only be consecrated once the king had approved of the election. And he also wanted all elections to take place in the king's own presence, in his own presence, which you can imagine how free and easy that would be. Henry II, however, had to give way, and particularly after his quarrel with Thomas Becket, the martyred Archbishop of Canterbury, after the murder of Becket in 1170, Henry II had to compromise with the church. And after that, elections were supposed to be free, although in practice, Henry II and his son Richard the Lionheart, and indeed John himself, continued to exercise an influence. And the majority of bishops appointed in England in the later 12th century and well into John's reign were royal clerks. That is, they worked for the king. That's a really interesting and important thing to know about the kind of relationship between church and state in the period. Some of the problems that could arise during elections, though, do show how bitter these relationships might be. At Winchester, and Winchester is one of the most important and wealthy bishoprics in southern England, at an election in John's reign, John wanted his candidate, his friend, his minister, Peter de Roche, to be elected as Bishop of Winchester. The monks wanted somebody else. John helped to finance Peter de Roche's appeal to the Pope. And in the end, de Roche was confirmed as Bishop of Winchester. A new player on this stage of interplay between popes and monks and kings and royal ministers, a new figure is that of Pope Innocent III, who became Pope in 1198. He's a towering figure in the history of the medieval church. He disapproved of clergy who held administrative offices. He was the author and the leading light behind one of the most comprehensive statements of canon law, one of the most important programs of reform of the medieval church that promulgated at the Lateran Council of 1215, later on in John's reign. He's got a very strong sense of the importance of the ecclesiastical hierarchy, of its independence, of the pastoral role of the clergy, and above all, of his own authority as Pope. The bishopric of Winchester, as I've said, was important and rich, but the Archbishopric of Canterbury, while not particularly rich, was incredibly important. So when Archbishop Hubert Walter died in 1205, and Archbishop Hubert Walter had been Richard I's choice, John wanted the monks of Canterbury Cathedral Priory to elect one of his ministers, John Gray. He's a clerk in the Royal Chancery or Writing Office. Did all sorts of useful work for John. John seems to have gone to Canterbury and asked the monks to delay making their election. And meanwhile, he sent messages to the Pope asking the Pope to put pressure on the monks to support his own choice. However, some of the monks, it's all very sort of convoluted series of events here. They, in the meantime, elected one of their own number, their own sub-prior, without royal license having been obtained. And they sent Reginald to go and see the Pope to get his, possibly to get his election confirmed, but just to see how the land lay and what had been said to whom at the papal curia in Rome. Reginald, the sub-prior, the archbishop-elect, seems to have gone a little bit further than his brief and said, actually, I've been elected. But his election had not been canonical because it had been conducted without royal license. John then went to Canterbury, confronted the monks and said, what have you been doing electing somebody without license from me? And they said, we've done nothing wrong. And then they proceeded to elect the candidate that John wanted, John Gray. So now there are two people who seem to have been elected. The Pope wouldn't confirm the election of John's candidate, John Gray, either, on the basis that there was an appeal pending. He quashed both of those elections, and a third election chose one Stephen Langton. And that, of course, was the Pope's own preferred candidate. Innocent III knew Langton. Stephen Langton's an interesting character. He's not the same kind of guy as Thomas Becket. Thomas Becket had been a royal minister. He'd spent his early days as the friend of Henry II. Stephen Langton was a scholar. He came from Lincolnshire, but he'd studied in Paris before the days of Oxford's becoming really as established as it did shortly afterwards. And he taught theology in Paris in the 1180s. He wrote commentaries on the Bible at a time when commenting on the Bible was the most prestigious form of scholarship. He was also committed to the idea of reform of the clergy and training for priests. Some medieval chroniclers may have sort of exaggerated this distinction of Langton as a scholar, but certainly he's a man of independent thought and learning and stature. He's exactly the sort of person that Innocent III would have wanted and did want. However, he wasn't the sort of person that John wanted, not at all. John opposed the election on a number of counts. He hadn't been allowed to exercise his own traditional rights. He didn't know Langton, and Langton had spent far too much time in Paris. Of course, Paris is the capital of Philip Augustus, John's arch enemy. You wouldn't be pleased at somebody spending too much time in Paris. John, however, had met his match in Innocent III. When he refused to accept Langton, Innocent wrote back. He said, "I will threaten your realm with interdict if you don't accept him." And he said, it doesn't matter that royal assent isn't formally needed because basically the election had taken place in the Pope's presence, so it didn't need to happen. Rather deliberately provocative. John, however, expelled the Canterbury monks, took their estates, and wouldn't allow Langton to even enter the country. In 1208, an interdict is imposed on England, and in the following year, John himself is excommunicated. The most serious action the medieval church could take, an action against a realm and against a king. John, in retaliation, seized all the property of clergy who wouldn't celebrate divine service, who wouldn't, as it were, defy the Pope. It was the feudal idea of taking people's property if they failed to carry out the services for which that property was the return, was the condition. What did the interdict mean for people? There were to be no masses in public until in 1209, Innocent III did authorise the private holding of masses in conventual churches behind closed doors. There was to be no burial in consecrated ground. Baptism and penance for the dying were permitted, these essential acts of mercy, these essential sacraments. And it seems that on the whole, the clergy did observe the ruling. And so there was a huge loss of spiritual services for people and decline of morale. Very difficult to gauge because our knowledge of what it must have meant to people comes from monastic chroniclers who, of course, are deeply affected by this. A lot of bishops went into exile. Langton himself, of course, hadn't even been allowed into the country. He stayed, interestingly, at Pontigny, which is another sort of reference to Thomas Becket, the martyred Archbishop of Canterbury. Becket had stayed at Pontigny when he was in exile from his Archbishopric of Canterbury. As to John himself, nobody was supposed to have contact with a king who'd been excommunicated. In practice, people did. And his barons were loyal to him on the whole. Perhaps that was partly what enabled John to kind of hold out much longer than perhaps even Innocent III expected. But the interdict could not be sustained forever, not least because as time went on, John's own political situation and financial position deteriorated. He needed to have some friends. And reconciliation with the Pope was one of the easier things that he was able to do. So he was prepared to come to terms with the Pope by 1213. That's, you know, quite a long time to be out of favour. And what were the terms that he agreed? He surrendered England and Ireland to Rome and agreed to pay reparations for all the clerical revenue he'd withheld during the time of the interdict. He agreed to pay an annual tribute to Rome. England became a special fief or possession of St. Peter. That is, in feudal terms, it was subject to papal overlordship. John himself did homage to the papal legate, so the papal legate acting on behalf of the Pope, and Langton was eventually allowed to return to England. And crucially, foreshadowing Magna Carta, in a charter of the 21st of November 1214, John granted the Church freedom of elections. The chronicler Matthew Paris, and I would be so grateful if this could ever be printed by Penguin Classics, because it is the most wonderful chronicle of the 13th century, but later than Roger of Wendover, a bit later on. But Matthew Paris is very pro-English. He sees this surrender to the Pope as a real humiliation. Whether people at the time thought of it as such is more difficult to know. Protestants of the 16th century thought it was an extremely bad idea. But they thought that John's stance against Rome was a good thing. As I say, people at the time were perhaps not so bothered. Modern scholars see the realpolitik behind what John did, see his move of reconciliation with the Pope and the deal that he did is actually a very skillful thing. You know, historians are always trying to change your mind about things because we need to keep our jobs. So people are desperate to find out something good, clever, competent that King John actually did. So this is one of them. And, it did pay some dividends, immediate dividends. Innocent III was very conciliatory towards John on the matter of elections. He sent letters instructing the papal legate, saying men should be elected to be bishops who are not only distinguished by their life and learning, but also loyal to the king, profitable to the kingdom, and capable of giving counsel and help. The king's assent having been requested. So, you know, it's nice to have the Pope on your side. When we're talking about whether John's got any goodness in him at all, it is, of course, worth remembering that there are his actions as a king, and then there are his actions as a pious man who is also a king. His private actions, if you like. And there are some things that suggest that John had his own character of piety, despite all the stories of his immorality, despite his excommunication, despite his cruelty to the clergy, despite his cruelty to the barons. His household made regular gifts to the poor. He seems himself to have had a special devotion to the Cistercian order. He founded Bewley Abbey in Hampshire in 1204, celebrations there too. Apparently this was in part out of his devotion to St. Hugh of Avalon. And it was a generous endowment. John was interestingly devoted to St. Wulfstan of Worcester. Wulfstan of Worcester was an 11th century bishop. He was an English bishop. He survived the Norman conquest and was one of the few English bishops not to be replaced by a Norman. He attended William I's coronation, and he professed obedience to William's Norman, Archbishop of Canterbury, Archbishop Lanfranc. But he also promoted English traditions sorry, English translations and annotations of Latin texts at Worcester Cathedral. So he bridges the divide, if you like. After his death, stories of his miracles spread and he was canonized, interestingly, by Pope Innocent III. And John adopted Wolfston as his own special spiritual patron. And it's partly because of this that John is buried at Worcester. So just a little nod to John's piety and the special character of that piety. But John's public relations with the church are what really lie behind the first clause of Magna Carta. It was clever. It was a clever clause because it referred to the liberties of the church having been granted previously. That meant that John's earlier grant of 1214 of the freedom of elections would hold good even if Magna Carta itself were to be repudiated, which is what happened. It was clever too that there was no threat of excommunication in the charter itself if it wasn't kept. Although it did say that the king would do nothing to procure that the terms of the charter would be repudiated, or that the liberties granted in it would be revoked. So the freedom of the church had an existence beyond and prior to Magna Carta. So when the Pope, at the request of John, and because he's John's right-hand man in a way, his ally, when the Pope annulled Magna Carta on the 24th of August 1215, the Pope referred specifically to the fact that after John had become reconciled with the church, he had conferred full liberty on it. So that was separate from Magna Carta. Magna Carta, the Pope declared to be unjust and illegal, granted under duress, and he forbade that it be observed under pain of excommunication. The trump card. As I did hint a bit earlier, John has been branded as an evil king. And you know, historians aren't usually regarded as heroic, but those who are trying to be heroic do try to reinstate him, but it's very difficult. But one thing you can say that John got right was dying. Of dysentery in 1216, and thus removing the cause of rebellion against him. A lot of the animus of the barons was against John himself. This is the following year. After the repudiation of Magna Carta, the country falls into a state of civil war. So the barons are in rebellion, London is occupied, the son of the King of France is threatening to take over. John's death meant the survival of the kingdom, possibly the survival of the monarchy, and it certainly meant the survival of Magna Carta. When John died, he left his son, a little boy, Henry III, as the next Plantagenet monarch. And Henry's advisers and those who remained loyal to him could see that Magna Carta and freely granting it would be a way of saving Henry III, saving his kingdom, because what would you be fighting about if the king had granted Magna Carta and if the evil king had gone away, had died? It is confusing to try to follow through every single clause of Magna Carta and see, did the clauses survive into the 1216, 1217 and 1225 reissues? The 1225 one being the authoritative, or if not the earliest, version. All of those versions of Magna Carta issued by the minority government of Henry III kept the first clause, but they kept it in a simpler form. The English Church was to be free and to have its rights undiminished and its liberties unimpaired. And there's nothing about elections as such in the eventual versions of that first clause. So, what's the lasting effect of that first clause? Did the king stop influencing elections of bishops and archbishops and abbots? If you look at the appointments of archbishops of Canterbury in the 13th century, between the time of Langton and the time of Robert Winchelsea, who is the last Archbishop of Canterbury in the 13th century, you have to look at them on a case-by-case basis. You see that the king certainly does sometimes have his way. As, for example, in the election of Boniface of Savoy. Boniface of Savoy is the uncle of Henry III's wife, Eleanor of Provence, so slight family connection there. Boniface was elected in 1241 under pressure from Henry. The Pope at that time needed again to keep the King of England on his side. Conversely, when Henry III's son, the Lord Edward, this is before he became king, and this is the grandson of John, when he wanted the monks of Canterbury to elect his friend and minister, Robert Burnell, in 1270, they wouldn't do it. They elected their prior, Adam Chillenden. The Pope, seeing that there was room for dispute, appointed somebody else entirely, the Dominican friar, Robert Kilwoodby. You don't, by the way, have to elect one of your own number as your head of house, as it were. When Kilwoodby died, Robert Kilwoodby, the monks thought, okay, we'll give Edward the First a break. And they chose Robert Burnell, but the Pope replaced their choice this time with another friar, John Peckham, a Franciscan. So what we actually see is not freedom of elections for the monks at all, but we see the king and the Pope negotiating to the exclusion of the monks. And by the middle of the 14th century, there's an increase in the number of papal provisions to bishoprics and archbishoprics, and leaving less and less opportunity for the monks themselves to have freedom of choice. One interesting case, but I must just, because it's the end of the 13th century, Robert Winchelsea, who was John Peckham's successor at Canterbury, was elected without interference by either king or pope. So he was elected by the monks themselves. But he turned out to be an absolute standard bearer for ecclesiastical liberty. This time, not in relation to elections, not in relation so much to criminis clerks, but to do with the burning issue in church-state relations, that is, who has the right to tax the clergy, and a great upholder of ecclesiastical liberty. A number of other clauses in Magna Carta affect the church. You could say that the majority of the clauses of Magna Carta affect those churchmen who are great landowners. Every time it says that the king's ministers mustn't interfere, that you mustn't overtax, you mustn't charge too much by way of feudal tax, that the king's ministers are to be responsible people. These things affect everybody. There are one or two clauses which are to have, which are to be the seeds of future royal policy. Clause 46 protected the rights of patrons to custody of the religious houses which they'd founded. And the king's position as upholder of ecclesiastical patronage rights was a long-standing thing. It was in royal courts that those rights were contested and upheld. And subsequent reissues of Magna Carta upheld and built up the king's role in this respect. So the 1216 reissue, for example, confirmed that cases involving the right to present to churches should be held before the justices of the bench. So that's on one hand, the king asserting his role in relation to patronage. Another thing that is going to, it's sowing the seeds for future policy. Clause 39 of the 1217 reissue of Magna Carta said that nobody was to give away or sell so much of his land that what remained to him was insufficient to carry out the services due to his lord. And that was actually the beginning of a process whereby the king stopped people from granting land to the church in a way that meant that the feudal services, the military services, would no longer be forthcoming to the next lord up and eventually to the king himself. And it foreshadows the great statute of 1279, the statute of Mortmain, which prevented anybody from giving land to the church. Now, that sounds drastic. In the end, a licensing system was introduced, which enabled people to go on giving. And so, indeed, they did. But the idea that the king will actually have control over the church, you can see the seeds of that in Magna Carta itself. So Magna Carta comes to be useful to the king. It's best understood as an enigmatic document. It casts its eye backwards and yet again forwards. There's no picture of King John to show you. The nearest thing one could possibly have is that rather sad little tomb effigy in Worcester Cathedral. John is the only king, I think, to be buried in Worcester Cathedral. And it's rather poignant that next to where he's buried, so is Arthur, the elder brother of King Henry VIII. But if we haven't got a real likeness of John, we have Magna Carta, and we can see Magna Carta perhaps not as a portrait of John, but a portrait of the political community of the early 13th century. Like any portrait, it's complex. Like any accomplished portrait, every detail is worth attending to. It's not just about the kings and the barons. There are many other interests represented as well. Women seeking the right not to be married against their will. Cities and boroughs and towns, merchants, people who are in debt, people affected by forest law, fishermen, all free men. And as I said at the beginning, what the king granted to his men, he ordered them that they observe in respect of their own. So it's not just about the barons. The circumstances of turmoil in which people find themselves always produce a variety of different responses, and a document as complex as Magna Carta is not a surprise. It's not exceptional in times of civil war. But although I understand why the two clauses are what people focus on. And I do understand that you start to read Magna Carta, you get to about clause 31, and you think, oh my goodness. But every single clause is a window onto the 13th century world, and we are so lucky.